The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 11 from the record of Going Easy. Yunmen's two illnesses. The preface. Without a body, a person suffers illness. Without hands, a person combines medicine. Without a mouth, a person swallows food. Without receiving, a person is happy and peaceful. Yet do tell, how can you recuperate from an illness caused by the medicine? The case. Great Master Yunmen said, when the light has not penetrated and dropped off, there are two kinds of illness. One is where everything is not clear, and before you there is something. The other is penetrating the emptiness of all dharmas, but vaguely there seems to be an object. This too is the light having not completely penetrated and dropped off. Again, in the Dharma body, also two kinds of illness. One illness is receiving the Dharma body as the Dharma, holding it and not forgetting, seeing it as if it exists. This is to fall on the side of the Dharma body. Another is, even though having passed straight through, you cannot let go. Next, carefully, attentively examine one by one. What breath is this? This too is exactly illness. So the record of easygoing. The Book of Serenity, Yunmen's words coming to us, and the words of the followers of Yunmen, and the followers of the followers coming down to us, these teachings, these words that are both helpful and challenging, useful and problematic. We might say koans are a kind of upaya or skillful means. Upaya, one of the great creations of the Mahayana, the great vehicle, which was a very small movement in the Buddhist tradition, did not arise till 300 or 400 years after the Buddha. And then all of these texts were discovered, and a new look, a fresh approach to Buddhism and to practice. And so this bodhisattva ideal is one of the wondrous Mahayana inventions or uncovering. This ideal that we practice not for ourselves or not just for ourselves, but we vow to use this life. We vow to use this life to heal a broken world, to do our best. And this bodhisattva vow, for me, not so much something that you can choose. Oh, that sounds like a good idea. But something that comes from deep within us. I think something that is hardwired in human beings. We all have this terrible question, what shall I do? What is important? What is worthwhile? And so many opinions were told in so many different ways by our parents, by society, by friends. You should do this, you should do that. And images come up in our mind and we think, oh, if only I was this, if only I had the right partner, the right job, if I had won that award, if I held this position, then... So this mind that imagines some other place, imagines it could be some different in somehow, gets in the way. And part of our practice is following what is alive in the moment. In our school, we stress having a practice, having something to come back to, the breath and body, sitting in shikantaza, in open awareness, looking into koan. So we have some direction, some clear direction, yet within this, within whatever practice you are doing, the challenge is how to stay alive moment to moment. And staying alive is not a matter of making sure you stay alive, but it is heading again and again. It is opening again and again to what is already happening. This happening of life, we might say Buddha nature, the aliveness of life, is mysteriously difficult to move close to because all of our ideas about it are extra, and all of our ideas about it are the thing itself. As I was thinking about this koan, I was remembering a particular concert I went to when I was in my early 20s at Wesleyan University, where both Melissa and I went, has a wonderful ethnomusicology program, and every year they would have a big celebration of Indian music, North Indian music, the subcontinent of India. And there was one particular American who was a graduate of Wesleyan who became somewhat of a rock star in India, and he sung with such passion and grace, and he was singing a song, and it was the song sung by someone who was outside the temple and looking into the figure of the god inside the temple, and singing this great song of longing. Why am I out here? Why can't I come into the temple? And this song portraying this seeing something in front of you, seeing why can't I be enlightened? Why do I always have to live at some distance from myself and watch myself and judge myself? And I was so touched by this song because it so expressed that great bodhicitta, this great heart of longing, this deep longing for something we cannot fully name, we cannot fully describe. And if we think we're longing for a thing, then we will be disappointed. As one of us said yesterday, you think you want a particular thing, and of course when you get it, it's never enough, or it's enough for a moment. And then we slide back into this longing. I came to my teacher once, George Bowman, in the middle of feeling totally distraught, feeling there was absolutely no hope. There was something, I knew there was something, and I could not get it. I could not attain it. I could not penetrate into it. And I was exhausted and in tears and just sitting before him crying out. And he sat and he listened. He did not say a word. Then he bowed, and the meeting was over. And walking out, I thought, oh, is this it? What appears as the problem, what appears as the illness, what appears as the condition that must be overcome. The great longing in my heart that for so much of my life felt like such a problem. The great longing that for me, and there must be some equivalent for you, or you would not be here on this great going easy. Way, which of course is not easy going at all, is it? But coming to see that one of these deepest longings in me, the deepest pain in some way, Paul spoke so eloquently yesterday about the loneliness. And I think we encounter this great loneliness of being a human being. We might say this is the great illness, the great delusion. We are born with no effort on our own part. We appear in the world. We're given food. Somebody changes our diapers and takes care of us well enough that we don't get run over by a car. We are constantly sustained by each other, by the work of the people that grow our food, that do all kinds of things, and yet we say, I am alone. And this delusion is not something we need to transcend, or not something that can be taken away. Of course, so much suffering, and when we see each other suffer, when we see people we care about suffering, we think, oh, I wish I could make it different for you. But fortunately, we can't. We can't protect each other, but we can be present, we can be kind, we can take care of, not by trying to make it okay, but by being present with each other through the wildness of all that arises. Being a human being is indeed a wild thing. We we are in the middle of something that is incomprehensible. Where did you come from? Where are you going? We vow, our bodhisattva vow, to meet what is here. And of course, the great faith of Zen, great doubt, great determination, great faith, is not the faith of taking someone else's word. It's not the faith of making sure that you have the right attitude toward the four bodhisattva vows. It's not the faith of pledging allegiance. It's not even the faith of becoming a Zen student. But it is the faith of being willing, even just a little bit, even for a moment, to let things be. In the middle of a life of striving and working hard, in the middle of here on retreat, of course, working hard in some way. Can you let yourself be? Can you give others to others and give yourself to yourself? Dogen talked about self-receiving samadhi, jijiyu zamai, self-receiving and self-employing. So the absorption of receiving yourself, of course, yourself in the sound of the traffic, yourself in the form of all of the thoughts and sensations, the brokenness of the heart, the discouragement. Can you receive yourself in the vision of the gladiolas on the altar, such a delicate and impossible shade of pink, grew right up out of the dirt in the middle of the rain and the heat and the cold, all winter waiting underground till the days were long enough and warm enough, and then appearing, growing straight up with no one telling it what to do. It needed no instruction. It is only and can only be itself. For a moment, thrusting up through the ground, blooming blossom after blossom on the tall spike. And then soon, like all of us, it will fall over, it will wilt, we will see the dreamlike quality, the dreamlike quality of all of this we are engaged in. So the skillful means of koans are useful, but if we hold on too tight, then the skillful means becomes the next technique that we need to let go of. One of the wonderful things about this koan, for me, looking quite closely into different mind states that arise, and different mind states that arise for all of us. If you hear a teaching and you think it's not about you, you haven't yet encountered the true teaching. All of these stories, all of these encounters, all of these chants are written by people like you and me who have looked into life. Sometimes Zen can seem so intellectual and complicated, and I, I don't understand this and I don't understand that. Our understanding in Zen comes when we give up trying to understand. When we bit by bit give up looking outside ourselves, and when we find our way home, find our way home to our own experience in this moment and this experience that is utterly ungraspable, this experience that is vast and subtle. That we can rely on even though moment after moment there is nothing to hold on to. But as we move through the many geographies of the mind and body over this time together, every place and every condition you encounter holds everything you need. And we have to slowly, bit by bit, and immediately here in this moment, hear the call of the bird. Feel the ache in the shoulders or knees. Feel the exhaustion. Feel the wild energy. Uchiyama Roshi says, everything you encounter is your life. This arising moment after moment, using jiju yuzamai, self-receiving and self-employing samadhi, the path of being who you are, the path of feeling what you feel. Each one of us here in this Zendo, and each one of us human beings is, we might say, is the gift we are looking for. I believe it was Yun Men Tu that says, each one of you has the light, has a light. But if you try to see it, you cannot. You can never know who you are because you are not a thing. You may look like a thing in the mirror, and you may be concerned about the various parts of the body and mind, but you are the arising of life. And there is the possibility of settling in. There is the possibility of giving up, as I spoke of on the first night. There is the possibility of gradually abandoning your opinion of who and how and when and what. The cost of entry into this moment is abandoning your opinion of how it should be. And when we enter the moment, there is the meeting. There is no inside or outside. There is no sound that I hear. There is no thought that I think. There is no mouth that opens and closes. There is only this wondrous functioning appearing as my foot touches the floor, as the floor so kindly receives my foot, supports me, and the next foot comes forward. Whose foot is this? Who is the one who is walking? And so the wondrous part for me this morning of this koan is the very last line. After discussing different kinds of illness, having passed through, having not passed through, mostly about separating in some way, about holding on, the instruction is carefully, attentively examine one by one, what breath is this? What is this breath? This too is exactly illness. This too is exactly awakening. This too is exactly your life. Thank you. So please sit comfortably, and people on the ends, come on around, make a little U-shaped. So, entering into this practice of speaking and listening, of coming forward and offering, what is alive for you as we look into this matter together? Jenny.
Something you said near the end that I'm pretty sure I've heard you say before, but I just heard it differently this time, that the price of entering this moment is abandoning your opinions about it. And what I heard differently was, like, I don't have to not have opinions about it. I just have to abandon them. Like, not hold on to them or orient towards them. Yeah,
I think that's a really important distinction, because we will always have opinions. So it's not about becoming somebody else. So you can let your opinions be as opinionated as they want to.
Yeah.
And the possibility.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
My opinion's opinion.
Yeah.
And this is the whole thing, you know, this is what Shabiyam means by opening the hand of thought. You're not getting rid of these opinions. You're not clutching them. You're just noticing them. I think that's directly what the koan says at the end. One thing after the other. Now this, now this, now this. We can hear these words over and over again, and suddenly there's a click like you had. He says, oh yeah. And then it's the way of going easy.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
I was really struck by this book of easy living. What is it?
Going Easy. The Record of Going Easy.
It feels like it's just such a fresh way to be with Zen.
Yeah.
I know, right? Like,
right.
You know, not, I just feel like that, you know, my experience is like, we need to work hard and push and, you know, and figure things out and, like, you know, just, and I love this easy, it feels so, it's just very sweet and, you know, and also, like, when we mentioned the longing, which I feel deeply also, but it's okay to have that longing and, you know, don't have to do anything about it. And just,
if you didn't have it, then you'd have something else. And this, you know, this is a translation of the word for serenity or equanimity, going easy. And Yunmin directly is commenting on the way that we get lost when we have these conditions, as we call them, sicknesses, illnesses. But you know, they're not they're the thing that's they're the thing that gets in the way, right? Trying to figure it out, trying to work hard. We don't know that we're tying ourselves up in knots. We think this is the way I'm supposed to do it, because some Zen communities really do emphasize that. And you can't just sit down by the side of the road and hope you're going to get home either. So it's both. There's some way of, you really bring everything to this, but not the old stuff about figuring out, I think you said, trying to make this work for you, getting something. But connected to what we've been saying, if you just open to that, then that'll go and be replaced by something else. You don't even have to worry about getting rid of working hard.
Yes.
That's great. Yes. You just, oh, there it is. Yes. There's me working hard. There's me.
Thanks. Bix, did you have your hand up?
No, I did have a question, but I didn't raise my hand.
Then I think it was Will first. So.
then maybe he gets priority.
No.
thank you for the talk. It was really, really wonderful and helpful. And in a way, it made me a little reluctant to answer this, to ask this question, just because. It isn't going to be nearly as wonderful as your talk, but it's a question about the discriminating mind, I guess. Let me put it very sort of concretely. I've been, you know, like probably some others of us, try to keep track of, you know, the exciting things that are being discovered in neuroscience, which is, you know, changes every year, every month, there's new stuff being found out. And that's, some of it seems to me to, and I'm not the first person, obviously we have books in the library too, that make some connection between something that is found out about the brain and the experience of meditation and Zen. I'm particularly interested in lateralization, so the right, left brain.
So what's the point
the
here?
The point is, you know, I stopped reading these books about the part of the brain that understands the world as a whole, and then the other part of the brain that is inherently dualistic. Because it seemed to me, wow, that's a lot like things I've learned through Buddhism. But it's not a first-person thing. It's third-person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's about the brain.
Yeah.
And I can't connect to your talk if I'm in my third-person mode.
Great.
Thinking about
great.
How...
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that noticing that will is so important. And a number of us in this room have advanced degrees and extra-large heads. it's a wonderful thing to be able to think, and there's beauty and there's insight, and there's something else that is beneath all of that, right?
It involves yourself.
Yeah, and so... You know, reading can be inspiring sometimes. I mean, and same thing about reading Buddhist stuff, you know, can be inspiring. But the image of the, you can't eat the menu. You know, you can look at the menu and say, whoa, duck flambé, you know, whatever. So I just want to reflect back and encourage you, yes, the way to go is through your own heart, into the heartland, whatever it brings, and the teaching is already there.
Right, however wonderful the menu.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And there's a time for that kind of thinking. So this is not better or worse, but certainly here and for me at the heart of all of this, and our real hunger and longing is not for some intellectual understanding. Yeah. So, thank you.
Could I just to add a bit to what David said so well? I have sometimes found those correspondences interesting, but the Dharma did not need neuroscience to validate it. What validates it is our lives when we fall in the way.
Right.
And that for me has been how I've built up the great faith part, not by reading about the latest brain study, but by what's happening in my life as I follow this wonderful path.
I'm actually going to riff off that as well, Ellen, because I was thinking as this was happening, and then what you said really, you said it so well. I was reading before Sasheen started Tricycle Magazine, and there was an article in it by a wonderful writer and poet that I'd never heard of before. But he just came out with a book about, you know, practicing in a time of crisis. I can't remember what the title was or what his name was at this point. But he makes the same points we're making right now about how neuroscience and all the new studies and mindfulness being so widespread can actually distract us from the essential point. And it's fun and it's great and it's, you know, we don't want to not know these things, but of course, did you say they change every week? Or I mean, look at medical science 100 years ago. We think we know stuff. And I think this guy is making the point that this is costing us this fascination with why things are the way they are, and it's not allowing us to actually be in this world that is full of suffering. It's like a wonderful distraction, even though it's helpful, and as Alan said, it can encourage faith in these things, but ultimately, you both said it better than I could say it right now, but I think you understand what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Will.
Thank you.
So Bix, with the question that...
David's just going to read everybody's mind.
Yeah. So you may be next if you're thinking...
Don't let him in. What is the question, Dave?
Well, haven't I answered it already?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what's coming forth for me, and maybe not so much of a question, but sort of, you know, I used to think that, you know, we're talking about opening the head of thought, and that's something I've been practicing with recently. I used to, and with that practice, you know, I used to think that the aversion to the pain was what caused the suffering, and now I actually think it's more like the aversion to the aversion.
Right. Yeah, the great teaching of letting things be. Yeah, wonderful.
And you know, the opening the hand of thought, it's a wonderful practice, and I love the book. And also looking at the thought is a wonderful miracle of a human expression. A thought, to think. It's not the enemy.
Yeah.
The thought itself, we can feel it, we can experience it. As soon as there's a me that has the thought, that holds it or just identifies with it, or saying, then it becomes something else.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks for the talk. It was a beautiful talk. Mm-hmm. And it hit some connection that reverberated to this article that I read just before I came. Mm-hmm. And it was about prisoners who have dementia. And so it was about how these prisoners get older and older. At some point, their dementia makes it such that they can't remember why they're being punished. They don't remember their crime, but they still are in prison. They're still suffering for what they don't know about. And so sometimes when you were talking, like, I can't relate to that. Sometimes I feel like that. I feel like there's this suffering. We don't really know why. We don't know what it's about. We still are in this way. And so, I don't know. Somehow the talk made me remember that. And feel that.
Well, and I think this is, in a sense, the Buddha's teaching. You know, we can think, why am I suffering? Why am I being punished by, you know, why am I being tormented by my mind?
Yeah.
And it can be useful to look into why, but ultimately, I think the liberation we're talking about is realizing there's not a problem to begin with. The as Sahi, maybe Melissa said, the problem is not the problem. Right, and then there's just the suffering, and as Bix was saying, the wanting it to be different, the aversion. Yeah, maybe we all, of course we do all have dementia, in that we all know quite clearly. Everyone sitting here, hasn't there been a time when you said, "Well, of course this is true," and then the next day, it's like, what are we doing here? What am I supposed to do? How do I live my life? Yeah.
When I was training in psychotherapy, in those days, you really were supposed to retrieve memories and work them through, memories of trauma. And then I ran into some people who taught something completely different, which is more in keeping with what we're doing and what we're talking about now. And I always remember my supervisor saying to me, when I had a woman who came in deeply traumatized by the aliens who had taken her on the spaceship, you know, and I said to my supervisor, what am I supposed to do? That's clearly not a true memory. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, what they actually remember, what we actually remember is irrelevant. But that woman is suffering. Mm-hmm. And so you move into not the content. You don't try to dig it out, you know, past life regression and all that. You just say, whoa, that's hard. I'm so grateful to him for that instruction. I don't apply it to myself as well as I could. And I think everyone I know is always trying to figure out, goes back to the depths, figuring out, what caused me to be like this? Something terrible must have happened. And sometimes we do have stories that you know, that seem to be really fixed. This really, really happened, and to just be suspicious, because I love those prisoners who can't remember what they did. We know something hurt us, because all human beings are hurt in some way, and then to move into the present moment, I feel like this, and to really be with that. It's almost impossible to do alone. You need a trusted friend, a guide, a therapist, a Zen teacher. But it's so tricky. It's so tricky. Somebody told me recently about an event that they were very clear about. And then the next day, I heard from the other person involved in the event, a completely different story. That was 24 hours later. You know, there's no way to remember what happened, but to really honor what's happening now.